Hey, this is James from Modern Day Debate, and you are listening to The Canadian Atheist.
The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
Welcome to The Canadian Atheist, a podcast about news, current events, and commentary on all things atheism from a Canadian perspective. Now, this podcast carries the explicit tag and wears it like a motherfucking badge of honor. So if you get offended, you might want to switch off. The CA records each week live from Apostasy Studios. Why not join in the discussion? Find us on Facebook, email us at theca@rogers.com, or follow us on the old Twitter machine at @the_CA_podcast. If we're amused or tweaked by your stuff, we just might even use it on the show. And now, here are Michael and Dean.
All right, here we go. Welcome to CA. Today is Thursday, February 6th, 2020. I am Michael, and sadly, Dean is not able to be here, but you can't expect two episodes in a row. His kids are ruining everything. But he'll be back next week, I promise. This is episode 101, so just after just getting through the centennial. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening to a couple of potty mouth heathens. Tonight I've got a guest who I'm really excited about talking to. He's one of the most humble experts that I think I've ever seen on YouTube. And he's joining us from just outside of Washington, D.C. You will, of course, know him from either Skylar Fiction's YouTube channel or his own channel, Digital Hammurabi, where he and his wife, Megan, do some great stuff there. And we'll chat more about that as we get going on. But Dr. Josh Bowen, welcome to The Canadian Atheist.
Michael, thank you very, very much. It was very generous of you to say.
Well, it's funny because, and we chatted by email just a little bit, and it was funny because I realized after I sent you one of the emails that you might have thought I was a troll, because and so everybody listening, how do you want me to address you, or how would you?
Josh is fine.
Okay, Josh. So I sent Josh an email. And it's funny because if you haven't had a chance, and so tons of people subscribe to Skylar's channel. So go after you get done listening to this, go to look up Skylar Fiction on YouTube, and look up Digital Hammurabi, and subscribe to that too, because he's got a great little series coming out that we're gonna talk about that a little bit later as well. But so I sent Josh an email, and it was funny because so my first exposure to Josh was on Skylar's channel. And so Skylar introduces him and he says, you know, he's this guy, he's got a PhD in Assyriology. I'm like, what the fuck is Assyriology?
And the standard response.
Yeah. And, you know, goes back and forth. And so, but as I was watching, here's a man who is an expert in Near Eastern studies, history of them. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And one of the most humble people that I said I've ever seen on YouTube. Josh, you are so quick to say, this isn't my field. I'm not an expert. I'm sure there's somebody who knows this stuff better than I do. And for someone who intakes way too much YouTube for one human to take in, I got to tell you that as opposed to your Christian counterparts, who profess knowledge they can't possibly have, you are always so quick to say, you know, I'm not an expert. And the humility. So anyway, in the email that I said, just draw this story out even longer. In the email I said, you know, if Jesus was a real dude, and because I still sit on the fence on the whole mythicism, historicism thing, I could imagine that he would be like you. And after I hit send, I'm like, I sound like a fucking idiot. And so, and it took Josh a few days to get back to me. I'm like, oh, he's blocked me for sure. Like he's written me off as some kind of whack job. But it's true, because when you're looking at YouTube and you're looking at Christian apologetics, and one of my favorites lately, and I'm sure you're aware of it, Cameron Bertuzzi,
mm-hmm.
right? Whose tagline is, by the way, Christianity is true, which pisses me off to almost no end. And then you're on the flip side of that saying, I'm not an expert, which you are. You're like, and sure, you may not be an expert on everything that you talk about, but I don't think that Johns Hopkins hands out PhDs to just any schmuck. So, for someone who is an expert, I find it refreshing that someone's prepared to say, you know, I may not know everything, but, you know, here's my opinion. Anyway, I'm going to shut up for a couple of minutes. What's the first thing I want to talk to you about? I wanted to talk to you about your background, because you are a former Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're not an atheist yet, you still identify as an agnostic. We'll get you there soon. but I did want to talk about your... I did want to talk about your background a little bit, because I'm not sure that all of our listeners have had a chance to hear it. So I wanted to get you to tell your story a little bit, because it's fascinating, especially, I'll let you tell the story, but I think your background is fascinating. So share some of that with us.
Sure. And again, thank you for all those very kind things that you said. sorry, I'm getting over a cold just like you are. So yeah. Apologize for the coughing. So, yeah, I grew up in a very fundamentalist, type of household, and learned the Bible from a very early age. My mother likes to tell the story that when I was 15 months old, I could say John 3:16, and I can still hear her voice as she still likes to tell that story. but, you know, my grandparents were absolutely instrumental in my life. And, he was an ordained Baptist minister. And that given that background, and I became a Christian when I was probably 5 years old. And it was who I was really for probably 25 years. I went to Christian school when I was younger, and then ultimately went to a public high school. When I graduated, I joined the Air Force, and while I was there, I went to Liberty Bible College to get my bachelor's degree in religion via distance learning while I was working on the flight line. And once I got my bachelor's in 2003, I became an officer and started a master's program at Capital Bible Seminary. And that was a master's of theology degree. So it was about 126 semester hours for that master's degree. And it took me 6 years to do it, write my thesis. And during that time, I taught Hebrew. I taught a little bit of Greek. But I ended up walking out with a master's of theology and Old Testament studies. So I did a lot of Hebrew, Aramaic, different kinds of Aramaic, studied a little Ugaritic, a little Syriac. But a lot of Semitics, and I took Akkadian while I was there. And for the listeners that don't know, these are just, you know, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible is written in the Hebrew language and some Aramaic.
Yeah, but he's not an expert at all, like in basically anything. Like,
no,
you've already said you speak like half a dozen languages, man. Come on.
I mean, so the thing is, like, I know people who are experts. So those are the people that I have in my mind when I think about these things. So I wouldn't dare compare myself to them. There are people that when I finished it at Capital, one of my professors pulled me aside and said, "Look, if you don't go for a PhD, I think you're going the wrong way." So he said, you need to apply for a PhD program. So I applied actually to a university in Baltimore just because it was closer and had a good reputation, but they didn't have any available slots that they were taking people that year. So my ex-wife, my wife at the time, she said, you should apply to Johns Hopkins. And I thought, yeah, and maybe while I'm at it, I'll apply to NASA. I probably have just as much of a shot as getting in there. They took me, and I was really excited about that. And I got into the Assyriology program. So Assyriology is the study of the languages and cultures of the ancient Near East. So ancient Mesopotamia. So I...
So if I could ask you, just pause for 1 second.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's totally fine. So ancient Near East. So if you could just lay out for us geographically, what, like, is that like the Middle East? Like, mm-hmm. like lay out where geographically what the Near East means when you're talking about this.
Sure. If you think about Iraq and Syria right now, that's, you know, roughly the area. It gets into Western Iran as well, but that sort of region there, the Iraq, Syria, you know, some of southeastern Turkey, or more of Turkey, but that whole region would be considered the ancient Near East. And we're talking about 3000 BCE to 300, you know, that roughly that period BCE when writing was invented in ancient Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia means between the two rivers. So the Tigris and the Euphrates River that run through Iraq and Syria, it's that area between the two rivers. So they spoke Sumerian and then later Akkadian. And those are the languages that I majored in. And I did a minor in Hebrew Bible because of my background in Old Testament studies. I graduated with my PhD in 2017, I wrote my dissertation on these sort of religious liturgical texts in Sumerian from, you know, probably the middle of the 18th century BCE. But
yeah, no big whoop. Yeah, okay.
Well, I mean, I was going to say that's probably too boring for anybody listening, but.
So you go to Starbucks and talk Sumerian with your friends?
Oddly enough, there aren't many people around here that are interested in that topic. But I was very, very surprised. So due to circumstances in my life, that probably don't need to talk about, I was not, going into academia was not an option. I got a Fulbright scholarship to go to Germany for a year. I studied in Tübingen with Professor Konrad Folk. And, you know, I was very excited. And I thought, well, on my way to getting an academic position teaching somewhere. But the way that there's some personal things that happened with my family that it kept that from happening. So, I ended up settling back where I grew up in Southern Maryland and doing construction, which, you know, I would have never guessed that I would have done. But it's anyway. And I thought that was just sort of it. I would study, you know, my stuff on my own. I for those that are listening that know about the Non Sequitur show when,
yes.
You know, it was going strong. I heard Aaron Ra talking, and I can't remember what the episode was, but I heard someone talking on the Non Sequitur show, and I emailed Kyle, and I said, look, here's my background. This is what I do. If that's of any use to you and Steve, let me know. And they emailed me instantly and then had me on the show that week, and they asked me if I was going to start a YouTube channel. And it was all downhill from there, I suppose. I feel like I skipped over probably the thing you were asking about, and that was sort of my religious background. So when I finished my seminary degree in 2009, I was teaching Hebrew down at just outside of DC, and I heard that I was getting into Hopkins on a full scholarship, and the then dean of that satellite campus said to me, "Are you ready? You know you're going into a very liberal school." And I remember I was holding my Hebrew Bible in my hand. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going into the lion's den. And I held my Bible up and I said, but I'm going to win souls to Christ.
Right.
And that's what I was going to do. And I always think about that moment when I hear people, particularly on social media, say things to me like, oh, you never really believed.
Oh, the no true Scotsman. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You were never
really
a Christian.
Yeah.
That's the moment that I always think of. But I went to Hopkins and, you know, it really in the first semester, engaging with the data, engaging with the history, the way that the depth, I suppose you could say, the detail that we had to do that, and engaging with the languages, it just became very obvious to me that my fundamentalist beliefs were not terribly strong. That's not a good way to say it. That what I had believed didn't hold up to scrutiny, I suppose. And I became an atheist for about a year. My understanding.
Oh, you were never really an atheist then.
No, definitely not. Couldn't have been. Because we know that from 1 John 2. You know, I know, I'm kidding. But, I knew that, everything was based on the inerrancy of the text, the inerrancy and the infallibility of the text. And if this is the inspired word of God, and here these historical things that I'm looking at simply didn't happen the way that I understood the biblical text to be presenting them, well, it's all bullshit. And so I became a pretty hardline atheist. Not that I was advocating for anything, but I mean, there was just no God.
So, I mean, okay, so then, so you have this kind of, could have had a V8 moment. And like, was it like, did you get mad? Like, cause just sitting here, I'm like, I'm mad for you. I'm like, I put my whole life into this and it's all not true. Like, did you get mad?
No. I was sad probably more than anything.
Okay.
And I don't know that I've ever come away from that sadness. And it's interesting to me because, you know, when I think about how my life was and how I lived my life, I remember things like I would drive somewhere and I would think, oh man, I wonder if I'm going to have a parking spot. Lord, please let me find a parking spot. And I remember when I would find one, I would, Lord, thank you so much for providing that spot. I would drive down the road and I would think, man, I'm late, and I'd want to speed. And I'd say, Lord, you know what? If you are in control of this, if you want me to get there on time, I'm going to follow your will. I'm going to obey the law and I'm going to get there on time. And if I'm late, that's because it's your will that you want me to get, but I'm not going to do something wrong. That's how it wasn't a part of my life. Everything, my life was a part of my faith. And so that those are the types of things that it was everything that my life was based around. My life was my faith.
Wow. Okay. So when you were talking, about the inerrancy of the text, so were you full on like 6 days, 6,000 years, world flooded, Tower of Babel, like the whole nine yards?
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, given my strengths, perhaps in languages, I don't know that this is always the case, but it is in mine. My strengths in the humanities meant great weaknesses in maths and sciences. So, I don't never really contemplated deeply, evolution. It really wasn't on my radar at all because honestly, I remember the few times that people asked me about evolution or I would say, well, you know, God created the earth with apparent age. Right. So when Adam was 30 seconds old, how old did he look? He didn't look 30 seconds old. He looked, 30 years old or something. So, You know, the trees, if you cut down a tree in the Garden of Eden, did it have rings? Yeah, maybe, because God created everything with apparent age. So, yeah, you show me a rock that's millions of years old. Well, I know that it's not. It just looks that way because that's how God made it. So, yeah,
The stars were created with the light already inbound to reach us.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's how God made it. And I was, if you know what this is, I was a dispensationalist. Without, I guess, going into any detail, I was
go into some detail, because I'm actually, that's one I'm not familiar with.
Okay. Yeah. So dispensationalism essentially looks at God. God gave different rules and guidelines in different periods of human history based on the recipients. And so the rules and traditions and laws and things that were given to the nation of Israel, obviously were not given to us today. The big distinction that my form of dispensationalism made was everything that was in the Old Testament, everything that was in the four Gospels, everything that was actually up to Acts chapter 8, the book of Acts chapter 8, all of that, Jesus' ministry, the apostles, the 12 apostles, all that was to the nation of Israel, okay, not to the church today. So really the only texts that were to us today were the Pauline epistles. So because of that, you know, I could draw very sharp distinctions between things that Jesus said and the things that were actually to us today that were written by Paul. And that form of dispensationalism, I would say probably all forms do, but it really drew into sharp contrast this present age and the age to come. And so we, you know, we looked for the coming of Jesus Christ in the clouds to receive us up into the air to be with him forever, and then the tribulation period to start here on the earth. I mean, this was how I lived my life.
See, and that's what I'm always looking forward to, right? Because then that's hookers and blow. I mean, like, you know, like you go on. You know, the coke is coming.
Take that Holy Spirit influence out of here.
Yeah. Exactly.
So for me, given the hope that I had. I actually tweeted about this recently. I have a Twitter handle. I think that's what it's called.
That's what it's called.
It's a DJ Hammurabi 1. And I tweet about this sort of stuff from time to time. But I went to a funeral last weekend.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I remember you talking about that a little bit.
Yeah. And, it's probably the single thing that I miss the most, and that is being sure about what's coming.
Right. Yep. And it's funny because I can completely relate to that, because when I lost my both my parents are gone. When my dad, we've talked about this a little bit. My dad, you know, didn't impact me as much. When I lost my mom, I was fucked up. And I noticed there were so many people who were they were able to take, I was jealous because they could take solace in something I could not take solace in.
Yeah.
And it pissed me off a little bit, because I was like, fuck. You know, it's like, what I did was say, well, it doesn't matter because, you know, they can take solace. It doesn't mean it's real anyway, so fuck that. But I completely understand where you're coming from, because it was the cure-all, right?
Yeah.
It was the Band-Aid that covered every wound.
Yeah.
And then it's not there anymore. So I can, yeah, that makes sense. Wow. Well, that's fucking downer.
sorry.
No, it's okay. No, I took us there. I took us there. Okay, so let's talk about your hardcore atheist, but now you identify as an agnostic.
Yeah, so...
So tell me what that means to you.
Sure. So I would say that, you know, if you ask me the question, does a God exist? I don't know that I'm qualified to make that call. So I, you know, for example, if I were Lawrence Krauss and I knew more about origins or cosmology or whatever, and I told you more than I understand, even there, maybe that would make me feel more comfortable saying things like, "Oh no, there's no God required."
Right.
Even then, I mean, this very well may be simply hangups. You know, these are habituated tendencies that I have. To think, because when I think, people ask me all the time, "Well, does Santa Claus exist?" I have no problem saying no. But in the same way, do I know that Santa Claus doesn't exist? I don't know that I can know that. But for some reason, when I think about a deity, it's a different category for me. I don't think that one exists. To be honest, I suppose in the end, it doesn't matter in that way as much as I would like, because even if a God exists, I don't know anything. I wouldn't be able to know anything about him, I wouldn't think, given what I know now. And I'm, as you say, I'm outside of my field here.
There you go.
So maybe there are ways philosophically that we could know those types of things, but I don't know what they are.
So do you ever get Romans 1 clicking in the back of your mind that, oh no, I really do know?
No.
Like, that doesn't happen anymore?
There are certain theological positions that I held that were very easy to put aside, to dismiss. I would say probably, I don't struggle much with theological problems. Thinking back through them and do I really hold to that or do I not think that that's, a reality? Is there really some truth to that? Those things don't bother me, primarily because I think because I can deal with the text in a somewhat detailed manner, I feel like I have the research capability to get to the bottom more than not of what the text is trying to say. I guess what I mean is I remember making very elaborate theological connections between texts. Oh, this is interpreting this text. And so, if we know this to be true and then this other thing says this, the overall point must be this. And a lot of those, connections were obviously, they were justified.
Right. And, sure. So when you were hardcore right into it, how would you, and if you can put those God glasses back on for a second, and I'm having a discussion with, hardcore Christian Josh, mm-hmm. and I say, okay, rabbits don't chew cud, right? It's like, I think it's Leviticus 11, right? Mm-hmm. And bats aren't birds. How might you have answered that as a Christian?
Yeah, I mean, those specific examples, I'd probably go back to the text. And I would hope that I would talk about genre. But I mean, in the end, I think probably what I would say is, look, God, when things come up that are incredibly complex, that I don't think have good answers. For example, something like the book of Daniel, I really don't think there are what I would consider to be good answers for an early date of the book of Daniel.
Ask S.J. Thomason. She'll tell you all about it.
This is true. noted. I'm not saying that there aren't good scholars that hold to those positions, but I think they hold them for theological reasons. They say as much. But when I get to that point, or why is it that God would command, Saul and the Israelites to wipe out the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15, endorse slavery in the Old Testament, which my book is, it's coming out.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that.
Oh,
for
yeah,
sure.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. That's fine.
But with those sorts of things, in the end, I think that I've said many a time, God's ways are not our ways. And so, you know, God had good and justifiable reasons for doing these things. And while I can get to some of them with you, really, I can't, there's no way that we can get to the bottom of God's reasons. And that was sufficient for me. It really was. And the thing is, I understand, I feel like I understand very well the positions of people that are coming at me in the Christian community that follow that sort of thinking and line of reasoning, because they would tell themselves, I think, that obviously that they're right and that they truly love me and want the best for me. And what the best for me is for me to repent of my sin and to come back to God, because I'm on the train tracks, right? The train is coming.
Yeah. Any minute now.
Any minute. But they are fully persuaded in their minds and that morally sufficient reasons, for example, is
right. Yeah.
Is an absolutely correct answer. And I look at people like Mike Winger, for example, and it's possible that I don't know Mike well enough to make this call, but some of my interactions with him, I really do think he's a genuine guy that really wants the best for me.
And he's just wrong.
I hate saying things like that, but I mean, I did.
It's fine.
I think there are, what I hope for people like that is that, I don't know if you've heard me give the hallway analogy.
I'm not sure, but no, so give it.
If you stand in a hallway and you're, you know, 25 or 30 room with an open door at the end of the hallway,
okay,
you can only see that much of that room, right? The door's width.
Sure, yep.
And that's how I picture people that are in many churches today, or people that haven't, become exposed to the text in a meaningful way. However, they can only see this much of the room. And the thing is, they realize it. They realize they're 30 or 40 feet back from the door. However, they take a couple of church steps forward, right? They go to a Sunday school class, or they read a popular book by Ravi Zacharias or something, or, you know, they watch some YouTube videos, and they take some steps forward in their learning. Now, in that hallway, they've taken some steps forward, but it's only been 2 or 3 feet they've moved. They can't see any more of that room than what they could, you know, 3 or 4 steps earlier, but they think they can.
Sure,
because yeah, they've taken those steps forward. And those are the most dangerous Christians that I encounter, because the type of Christian that I was. I'd taken these steps forward. I'd gone to I've read these books, and I went and got my bachelor's degree in religion, and I went and got my master's degree, and I take further steps down the hallway, and I could see the room starting to open up a little bit in front of me. And I thought, my God, I know so much about this room. And I've mastered it, because look, I can see everything that I can see, I've mastered. And it wasn't until I stepped into my PhD program that I walked into the room and turned around and saw that the room was actually, you know, 1,000 feet in either direction and 17 stories up. And I went, holy fuck, I don't know shit.
Right.
Because, but the problem is that I think there are so many people that interact with the Bible and they've taken these little steps forward. And there's obviously nothing wrong with doing that. But the component I think that they miss is they don't recognize what they don't know. And it's so unbelievably dangerous. I mean, I guess I could have said that, what's the old adage? You know enough to be dangerous. And I guess that's a much easier.
Well, no, but it's interesting. That's what one of the people that I never got a chance to meet was Christopher Hitchens. I managed to meet a lot of my heroes in the movement, but I never got a chance to meet Hitch. And one of the things he always said was something related to what you just said. He said, knowing how much you don't know is what he always determined as the mark of a truly educated person. Mm. You know, instead of having the hubris of saying, I've already got it all figured out.
Huh.
You know, standing back And you to continue with your analogy, standing back, well, I've taken steps forward, haven't stepped inside yet. And where you had the where you had the humility to say, I don't know a fucking thing, these guys say, no, I don't need to go. I don't even need to go inside the room because I already know.
Yeah.
And that that degree of hubris is astounding.
Yeah.
It truly is.
It's dangerous. The one thing that I see over and over again is people will, I don't want to say latch on, but I can't think of a better way to describe it now. They'll latch on to one, maybe two sort of pet scholars in a particular field.
Yeah.
And they'll say, look, you know, because that's what I did, right?
Yeah.
And that scholar, they'll cite other scholars, they'll cite peer-reviewed literature, you know, they know the text, but they have a very minority interpretation, right? They hold to a minority position amongst other scholars in the field. But because they have that degree, because they have that ability to do that research and to articulate it in that way, to the reader, that's sufficient. They must know what they're talking about. I can rely on what they're saying. I can rely on their interpretation.
Yep.
And I think our channel is, you know, it's designed, we end almost, if not every video with, always ask, how do you know that?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And it's because what we're trying to get across to people is that in any of these hotly debated topics, particularly in these hotly debated topics, I think the first thing that everyone should do that's not a specialist, even if they are a specialist, go figure out what the consensus view is. What is it that all the people that are trained in this field, what is it that the consensus view is? Now, if there's not a consensus, if it's something that hasn't been researched enough, fine. But most of these things don't fall into that category.
Yeah, for the most part, these are not new arguments.
Exactly.
They're just getting rehashed, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. So, something you said there is interesting. You know, kind of people latch onto one person. Are you familiar with a guy named Blake Genta?
I'm not, no.
Okay, so he has this. He was on the podcast maybe 2 years ago, and he has. This app or like a website called Belief Map, and he latched on to Gary Habermas.
Okay.
He was to him, the minimal facts argument was the fucking home run. It was Babe Ruth pointing. It was everything. And I said one thing, I'm like, why would you want minimal facts? Like, why are you prepared to hinge everything on the very least amount? It's like, I remember reading some Bertrand Russell said, he said, we should always be prepared to hang a question mark on most closely held beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's like, why don't you want like minimum? Okay, fine. This is the minimal thing. But why wouldn't you want the maximum thing? I know this maybe sound like it's overly simplistic, but it's like, why would you just like, so if I at least have this, then everything I've got is justified. Because I've got this minimal facts. And in my head, it's like, that's bullshit. You know, when we're always trying to learn more and more, why would you settle for the least amount?
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's, I know I say this a lot. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been doing obviously a lot of research recently on slavery in the Old Testament. And one of the things that I have to do, part of it's, you know, wanting to be a good scholar, but there's, if that wasn't enough motivation, fear that I'm going to miss something is also a really good motivator when it comes to doing research. I can't tell you how many books and articles that I've either purchased or, you know, downloaded, read, whatever, on slavery in the past year. And every time that I do, I you have to do it this way. I approach the book, particularly if I know the person might disagree with me. I have to approach it saying, okay, I have to take this argument seriously. And it's a blessing and a curse on social media if you take that approach. It's a blessing because you end up going down every conceivable rabbit hole that people take you down.
Yeah.
But that's also the curse, because how did I say it? Let me throw this argument up against the wall and see if it sticks. You know,
exactly. Yeah, the whole people. Yeah, throwing up shit at the wall, some sticks. Yeah, for sure. Yep.
And it, you know, it becomes incredibly time consuming, and I have to gain some wisdom about how to not feel it my responsibility to answer all of those questions that people put forth. But I feel like I take those from people that I don't think are very good at what they do. I have to take their argument seriously, and it's not because I'm some, you know, wonderfully moral or whatever person, honest person. It's because I think, all right, they might, or whatever, that's not nice, but you know, they might not have thought through it all what they're saying, but they, you know, when you go into a street fight, you have to anticipate that guy that doesn't know how to fight, maybe somebody showed him one good move,
yeah,
right? No, and that's how at these things. And so hanging that question mark. It's hanging that question. I think it's a really good way to say it, hanging that question mark on close sale beliefs. So,
okay. So you kind of segued into it. So you got this book thing coming out. What's the deal with that? Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, we published in late December, early January. Megan, my wife, and I wrote a Learn to Read Ancient Sumerian for the Absolute Beginner, I think was the title. And
that's me. You know,
actually, I think I've got it. There it is. It's our first publication. And
no one else will be able to see it, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, I know, but you can see it.
I'll make sure I get a link from you, and I'll put it in the description of the podcast so people can go look at it and buy it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's incredibly generous of you. I really appreciate that. Robbie Press, Megan learned how to publish books. She bought the ISBN number and registered and everything. So that came out. We've sold about 200 copies of it now. It's basically just, you know, learn to read Sumerian language. But once we did that, it was like, oh, well, gosh, we can publish stuff pretty easily.
Right.
And I had done quite a number of videos on slavery in the Old Testament, did the Old Testament endorse slavery. And I had all of my notes and scripts that I'd written. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to turn this into a book. Because I think this is actually something that people would like to have. So the book is, that's the title, Did the Old Testament Endorse Slavery?
Okay, so let's just, before we get into that, because I've seen you going back and forth, and for everybody who's not aware of who we're talking about, S.J. Thomason is a Christian apologist on Twitter who loves to toss arguments out there and almost never engages. Really pisses me off, but hey, that's another episode. Anyway, we, you know, it's like you guys, like you and Skylar, have gone through this whole thing, and like, so to a layman, it kind of comes down to just Exodus 21. And I don't know how you read Exodus 21 and come away with anything other than yes. I don't know how you come away with anything else. And I'm just you're the dude with three, religious degrees, including two religious degrees and then a PhD in ancient Near East stuff. But to just a layman, I'm just like, all you got to do is read it. And here's someone who has, like SJ, who's read the same thing. And it's like, no, yeah. totally. The answer is totally no. And comparing antebellum slavery to this, I'm like, just read the text, just read it. You know, it's I know I'm rambling to people because we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, but when the text says, if the person had a wife, then, after the Jubilee, they leave with it. But if the owner gave them the wife, then they have to stay. And the guy can say, I love my wife, I love my children. And I think it says, I love my master too. They go to the townspeople and they drive the awl through the ear, and then it's property. I don't understand how you can beat them. And if they don't die after a couple of days, it's okay because they're your property. would you put the word property in there? To me, it's like fucking argument done.
Yeah, I mean,
I feel like I just fucked your book up. But
No. Because see, the interesting thing, God, I say that a lot. I apologize to the listeners. I say it's interesting. But there are three primary passages that deal with slavery in the Hebrew Bible. You know, the one you just described, Exodus 21, then there's Deuteronomy 15, which I think was written later than Exodus 21, sort of the standard view of it. And then ultimately Leviticus 25 and the Holiness Code. And when you look at, and of course, this none of this is original to me. So the book is essentially bringing together scholarship, consensus scholarship on this topic, and presenting it in a palatable way that's easy to search and you know, get a handle on. It's written in very non-specialist language.
Good. I'll be able to understand it perfectly then.
The thing about, so Exodus 21, I mean, you're absolutely right. What I hear people saying in response to that is not so much, and I'm sure you've heard this as well ad nauseum, but it's not that they come back with, no, that's not, that they weren't slaves, you know, I mean, they might say they were servants. But it's not that they deny the facts, or maybe they do, but for me, they don't generally deny the facts. What they say is, yeah, well, it was better than, right? I mean, sure. Well, I mean, yeah, it was better than. The problem is, it really wasn't, and that's part of what I go into in the book. You know, there are some aspects of slavery as described in the Hebrew Bible that are progressive, but they're generally progressive Israelites.
Oh yeah, no, it's funny. Well, because and it says that in the in the beginning of Exodus 20, where it says, you know, it's like for your Hebrew slaves, and so it's laying out one set of rules for the Hebrew slaves, but those rules are not the same for the ones if you go in and conquer a people and you take the plunder and you take the people. Like it's clearly laid out. Here's the Hebrew slaves stuff, and here's everybody else.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that becomes most clearly. Clearly displayed in Leviticus 25, because, you know, in Exodus 21, it says you can have Hebrew slaves, you know, and here's what you got to do. You sell your daughter. She doesn't go free like the male slaves do,
yep.
You know, but you got to take care of her. You can't, you know, if you marry another woman, you can't just do it. If you do away with her things, well, then you have to let her be redeemed. You can't sell her. As you described the male slave, and then, you know, in verses 20 and 21, you know, if you beat your male or female slave with a rod and he dies under your hand, well, then, you know, probably it's debated what that word nakam means there. But let's just say for the sake of argument that it means you're going to be killed.
Right.
But if he doesn't die, if he gets up after a day or two, if he survives a day or two, then you're not to be punished because he is your silver. He's your money. He's your property is a fine way to translate that. And what's more telling, and it doesn't come up all that often, I talk about it in the book, is later on with the in Exodus 21, that the different scenarios when an ox that is loose gores someone.
I've heard you talk about this, but yeah, lay it out because it's interesting.
You know, so if an ox is known to gore, it's gored people before, and the owner doesn't take the necessary steps to, and it gores a man, a free man, or a free woman, or one of his children. Well, it's death, right? Now, a ransom can be set if that's more beneficial to the victim's families, and that ransom is set by the family, and you know all these other. But it's death is the response. But then the text says, if it is a slave, 30 pieces of silver, and that silver is, as Raymond Westbrook points out, Exodus 21 is a little, and not just Westbrook, but it's interesting in the way that it deals with how they understand slaves. So in Exodus 21, 20 to 21, and in 26 and 27, with the putting out of the eye or the putting out of the tooth, slaves fall under more like family law, right? They're treated more human in that respect, even though it does call them silver. It's death if you kill your slave, right? However, in the ox scoring situation, they're under property law, right? Yeah. The payment is for the life of the slave. And the rationale that's been sort of supposed there. I won't go into all that, but that's Exodus 21. When you get to Deuteronomy 15, you've got a later text. I think it's a later text, and it's a developed text because now the law says, all right, you can have, you know, Hebrew slaves, but when you set them free, you have to give them stuff. You got to provide them from your wine press and from the field. And you have to make sure that when they go out there, they have provisions so that ostensibly they don't fall back into poverty and have to sell themselves as slaves to you again. And that's a development, and that's definitely progressive. There's no question about that. But again, it's for Hebrew slaves. When you get to Leviticus 25, the even later text, it says, no, 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 you can't make an Israelite a slave. Can't do it. If you want slaves, you can only get them from foreigners. You can get them from the nations around you,
yeah,
or from those foreigners that are dwelling in the land. You can keep them forever. You can pass them down as inheritance to your children.
Yeah.
They will be your property. But you must never treat your fellow Israelites in this way. And that's the most stark contrast that I see. You can no longer treat Israelites as slaves. Well, if you want slaves, where do you get them? Got to get them from the foreigners. And the thing is, that's not really, in academic circles, that's not really a debated thing. Even though it sounds like it's really debated when you hear it on social media.
Right.
But that's sort of the point of the book, is to lay out, all right, here's what consensus scholarship says about this. That book, Megan has just put the cover together, and we're going through the final. I put the index together that cited all the pages where the different verses were and the different citations were, and then we had to reformat it slightly, which meant that all the page numbers were thrown off. So I'm having to go back through all of it again. But it should be by the end of February, maybe even sooner. That book will be out, ready for purchase.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, we'll get a link for that in the description for the podcast too, so people can get their hands on that as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so how did so the next thing that I wanted to talk about is this the Digital Hammurabi video series, the Anna Mesopotamia.
Okay.
Tell us about that.
Sure. Just sort of as background, Megan and I wanted to get the ancient Near East out to everybody. What is Sumerian? What is Akkadian? And what are these? What text do we have? You know, when people study the Bible, realize that we don't have the originals, right? We don't have what the prophets wrote down. We don't have what Paul wrote down. You know, we don't have these things. We have copies of them, and sometimes those copies are much, much later. With Sumerian and Akkadian texts that are much, much older, we have the original clay tablets. You can see people in the clay. We have them, and we have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of them. They haven't all been translated yet. I mean, there's so many of them, and they're of all different genres. We have religious texts, you know, literary texts, liturgical texts, legal texts, seemingly stupid little economic texts, receipts, letters, all these things. We have it all. And I think that people, our impression was that people, non-specialists, just in general, don't know about that stuff. And so we started putting videos out. Well, Megan got the idea that, after about a year, we should put out like a kids channel. And she's very good at drawing. And so she put together these little animated characters. And we decided we were going to call that kids channel Anna Mesopotamia. So anime and Mesopotamia sort of mashed together. It's not really anime, I guess, but animated maybe is what she was going for. But Anna Mesopotamia, and she's just put it out. She just started the channel, or just published it, or whatever one does with that channel. And I think she's got three videos up on it. But we do things that it's geared toward middle schoolers, that sort of level. She did a video on what is Mesopotamia, I think, what is cuneiform, What languages did they speak in ancient Mesopotamia? That's the sort of level that we're shooting for. Hopefully, you know, kids that are in social studies in middle school will be able to click on YouTube and watch a 3, 4, 5 minute video, and it'll be reputable. It'll be based on good scholarship, but it'll be easy to understand and entertaining, hopefully.
Well, that's good. And small digestible bites too, because
yeah.
You know, middle school, I mean, like my attention span is 3 minutes. So it's, yeah, unless it's porn, then it's a solid 4. okay. That's cool. Now, here's a question that I wanted to ask you. So as a former Christian, Who are the Christians? I'm throwing you right into the fire here, but who are the Christians that you see that piss you off, like how they act with the things they do and things like that, the arguments they use, whatever.
There was a video very recently that just went up on a bunch of apologist channels. I'm trying to remember. They were all in a room together. Do you know the video I'm talking about? All these apologists. Let me see if I can remember them. Not all of them, but Mike Winger was one. Michael Jones. What's Woody Amin's name? John something. But you know the video I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I saw it flip through my feed, and I looked at it, and I'm like, maybe later.
It was called something that, but anyway, I kind of skipped through it, and it's basically all these apologists in this room, and they're passing a mic around and they're answering questions from their respective audiences. Individually, if I were to talk to any one of those guys, because they were all men in there, by the way, so I found it interesting.
Well, that's fairly biblical, though.
Yeah, it is. I guess it depends on how you, but yes, I agree. From that perspective, I think if I were to talk to any of them individually, they probably wouldn't rub me the wrong way necessarily, because people obviously interact very differently when it's one-on-one.
Oh, the mob mentality for sure. Yeah.
But all together, it was just a room full of arrogant men.
Really? Interesting.
And,
okay.
And that's how, I'm not saying that they're arrogant people, but I can tell you as a viewer, that's what it screamed to me. And I struggle tolerating arrogance. I feel like I do it, maybe not terribly well. The posture that they had as a group was, you dumb skeptics.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
You know, your arguments are so silly and so old, and we have the answers. And the thing is, I don't obviously know who all of the apologists were. Perhaps many of them are experts in their fields. That's possible. I didn't see any that were experts in their fields, particularly in the fields that they were discussing, but maybe they are. I just don't know it. But I just think, you know, I interacted with Dr. Michael Brown on Modern Day Debate maybe a year ago, and I really enjoyed, because we talked about slavery in the Hebrew Bible.
Okay.
And, you know, people thought I was a fanboy of his of some sort because, you know, I was just so smiley and so, you know, oh, that's such a good point. But the thing is, he was such a nice guy to me. And when people are like that with me, I love that. I love interacting with people that are like that. And so I'll seek common ground.
Sure.
And I think that was why that conversation was so beneficial. But the nice thing about him, at least in that conversation that I had with him, and we've talked a little bit since off air, is that I said to him, all right, you know, I don't want to get into stuff that we really disagree about, but what do you do with Leviticus 25, 44 to 46? And his response was, yeah, that's a tough one. You know, I don't know what to do with that.
Well, that's at least honest.
Yeah, it was amazing because think that, you know, the Old Testament, I think God is putting up with a practice and trying to bring a practice forward, you know, sort of a standard thing that, you know, that people say. He said, but I don't understand what God's doing in Leviticus 25, that section of Leviticus 25. I trust that there's a good reason, but I don't have a good answer for that. And that just warmed my heart.
Yeah.
Because that attitude, that's not what I saw in that room of apologists.
And it's interesting because it is something you can build on. A couple weeks back, I had a conversation with Dr. Christopher Gadson. And I first saw him on Cameron Bertuzzi's channel. And it was like a triggering video because it was like, you know, we're going to get together, you know, a couple of Christians are going to get together and talk about what atheism is. So I was like, fuck these guys. So I watched the video, and then I sent him a message on Twitter. We communicated a little bit through email, and he came on. And we had a great talk.
Yeah.
We had a great talk because it wasn't just two Christians jerking each other off under the table.
Yeah.
And you can actually, you know, have the conversation and when I would say, you know, what do you think about this? He's like, yeah, that's a good question. I'll have to think more about that. And, you know, he was able to ask me some questions. Like, you know what? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
And when you can have those, but yeah, I see what you mean. And now, of course, I'm going to have to go back and find that video and watch it. And then I'm going to punch my computer. And then you're going to have to buy me a new monitor. No.
I apologize. I mean, in that scenario, like I remember, again, like I'm just thinking of Mike Winger's sort of standing out in my mind there. You know, we interacted on Twitter. He was talking to somebody, and I don't even remember what the topic was, but it was something about Hebrew came up. You know, what does the, you know, the Hebrews say in this particular passage? And I messaged him as much on the sly as I could. I didn't want it to be like some big thing that everybody saw. I don't know if I know how to do that on Twitter terribly well. But I wrote, hey, I'm sure that you have people that you can go to, but if for whatever reason you ever, you know, need anything when it comes to like Hebrew or something, please feel free to ask. You know, I might not have the answer, but you know, maybe I can help. And it was nice, you know, he wrote back, thank you. And it was, but that's what I mean. Like I feel like he's a genuine guy, but man, in that group as a whole, sort of, we know.
It's like, we like toxicity? Know better. Like, did you look at it as like a toxic environment? Like
it was just,
or just like a bro camp, like everybody patting each other on the shoulders and congratulating each other.
I just think there was everybody's individual confidence in what they believed multiplied when around us. And look, I am very well aware. I have no illusions. This happens in skeptical circles as well.
Oh,
like
yeah.
I'm not saying that at all.
Yep.
And I am absolutely positive that I am guilty of this. Like there's no question. I really try hard not to be arrogant about things, but I am sure that I am sometimes. And I hope that people will point that out to me when I am. But it's just very common to me to see, you know, you poor stupid atheist. You just don't know any better. And in those moments, I don't ask these questions. You know, of course, I don't ask them to them directly usually. But, you know, in those moments, I ask the screen, do you know Hebrew? Do you know Greek? You
exactly,
know,
yeah.
Where's your PhD in philosophy?
Yeah.
You know, and again, some of them have it. I'm not suggesting that not all of them. But in those scenarios, I just think, God, you're just... There's such arrogance that exudes, and I just, why? What, yeah, anyway, sorry.
No, it's all good. It's all good stuff, man. All good stuff. So who do you think most, has had the most influence on you as you've started to navigate your way through this, agnostic, period of your life?
Like, gonna send my answers.
Is there stuff you've read? Is there like?
Yeah, I would say, It's going to sound odd. I feel okay saying his name here. When I was at Hopkins, I went through the program with Dr. Caleb Howard. And Caleb is, I feel comfortable calling him my best friend. He's out at Tyndale postdoc out in, where's he? Is it Cambridge? Is where Tyndale's at? I think so. And, you know, he's a researcher out there and just a brilliant ancient Near Eastern scholar. He went to Moody to get his master's degree. No, he didn't go to Moody. I'm sorry. He taught at Moody while he was out there. He went to Trinity to get his master's degree, studied under Richard Averbeck and Lawson Younger. And just we went through the program at Hopkins together. He minored in Hebrew Bible like I did. He majored in Assyriology. He wrote his dissertation on scribal practices in the first millennium, but just brilliant. And it's funny because I would say he's more brilliant than I am, and he would probably say that I'm more brilliant than he is, and it's one of the reasons we're so good together. And he's probably, if he ever hears this, he's probably hating me for saying all that. Sorry, Caleb. But, you know, he was there through that. And I remember having a conversation with him. I mean, you know, you have to picture this. I've known the flood happened the way that Genesis 6 through 9 said that it happened, right? I've known that my whole life. Of course that's true.
Sure.
And then I find out, what the hell? You know, the biblical text is taking this from another ancient Near Eastern text, you know, and that reality is setting in. One of obviously many, many things. And everything just unraveled. And I remember we were at a conference in a friend's basement where we were staying around Chicago. And he said, so tell me about this. Why are you an atheist now? And I said, well, I mean, just take, for example, you know, the flood didn't happen the way the Bible said. And he said, what do you mean how the Bible said? And I thought, like, what do you mean? Look, read it.
What do you mean? How do I mean? Just right. Look at it.
And his point was, what is the genre of that text? Like, what is that text doing? Is that text saying, all right, here's scientific or historical, you know, this is a historical depiction in the sense that we would think of a historical depiction of how the world was destroyed by a universal flood. And he was the one that sort of really made me engage in a much deeper level with the complexities of literary genre and as it pertained to the Bible. And of course it just that of course spread during the PhD program, but he was the one that sort of, I don't know, he consistently sort of pulled me back from what he would consider the edge. And I think that it sort of mellowed me in a way. Now, that doesn't mean that this is the position that I'll always be in. This might be a comfort thing. I'm here because this is the least scary place to be given the circumstances. Maybe that's what it is. But he had a tremendous influence on it. And, you know, but the thing is, I think the last thing I'll say about this is I hear a lot, you probably do too, that, oh yeah, all these scholars in liberal scholarship, the reason that they say that, Daniel's written in the second century, for example, is because they say the supernatural is not possible. They have a bias against the supernatural, and so they have to date it in the second century. What I find interesting about that is the majority of the scholars that are sitting on my shelf, their books that are sitting on my shelf, are Christians. You know, I think John Collins is a Catholic. He's up at Yale. Chung Leung Seow is an evangelical scholar. Yeah, I'm thinking of some of the names. John Goldengay is an evangelical. I don't know about Carol Newsom, but at any rate, so often the people that you end up reading in biblical studies, you know, they're theists.
Right.
They're not these hardline atheists that are out to destroy the Bible. The reality is, and I hate to say it this way, they don't give a fuck. Like, that's not the point.
Well, it's interesting because my thought would be, it's like, you've gone through all this problem. You got a whole bunch of letters after your name. You've done all this study. You're not going to, and this is from my perception, is you are not going to put all of the work you've done at risk by saying something that you want to be true that you can't back up, because then your credibility is fucking gone.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes this so perplexing and motivating to me at the same time to engage with people on social media. And that is that there is this perception that if you don't hold to a fundamentalist or an inerrancy position of the biblical text in the way that, you know, I was raised, for example, you know, you're out to destroy the Bible, and the reality is far less flashy.
Right.
I would say many people in, for example, the I'm thinking of several people on the faculty at Hopkins are Protestants or, you know, Catholics, or they're theists, right? And you would think that, oh, well, when they're teaching through the book of Genesis, I remember taking Genesis with Kyle McCarter, and, you know, you would think that all the time, or taking Ezekiel with Ted Lewis, that you would think it would come up all the time. Well, you know, you've got somebody at Hopkins that's teaching through Ezekiel. He's going to go right for Ezekiel 26, and he's going to talk about how Tyre didn't get destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, blah, blah, blah. It's like when you get to chapter 26, you talk about it sort of in passing, and then you move on, because that's not what that's not the point. Nobody's there trying to destroy the Bible. I'm not saying that no scholar does that. Obviously, there are people that do it, but on the whole, as you say, their credibility gets shot if they're. I mean, it becomes what the one thing that you don't want is a noticeable bias that's motivating your research and your conclusions.
Yeah,
and if you have that, I mean, it just, well, I mean, for somebody like me, for example, I still have to, because he's working with data, but my another friend of mine, Stephen Anderson, not that Stephen Anderson, Stephen Anderson.
Yeah, clearly not Sackcloth and Ashes. Yeah. Yeah.
He was a friend of mine that went to a Capital Bible Seminary with me and went to Dallas Theological Seminary and got his PhD. But he wrote on Darius the Mede, you know, trying to defend an early dating of Daniel. And I love Steve. I remember telling him that my first daughter was born, right? I mean, I remember reading through his Akkadian translations in his dissertation, kind of checking it over for him, because that was what I did. But, you know, Steve has a very long, I think it's a footnote in maybe chapter two of his dissertation, where he basically says, Daniel is not just some other writer. He is writing under the inspiration of the you know, the God of this universe. I'm paraphrasing it, but he is not just some other historian. No, you can't use other historians or other, you know, texts of the period to judge Daniel. No, Daniel is the standard by which we judge all other historical documents. And it's like, well,
fuck.
Sorry. I mean, I'm gonna read through what you say and deal with your evidence, but a bias that's pushing you into this conclusion.
Yeah, like that's not adding anything to it. It's funny. I remember I'd have these conversations with people, and one of the people that I would reference a lot, because I don't know the same people that you do, I haven't read the same things you have, but I would reference Francis Collins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and say, like, here's a, you know, founder of the Human Genome Project, you know, brilliant man, Bible-believing Christian. You know, and, you know, fell to his knees. You know, Christopher Hitchens tells the story because they became quite close when he was diagnosed with cancer. And Francis Collins Hitchens tells the story that Collins was telling him, saying, you know, I was walking, you know, through the woods, and I came upon basically a water formation that had come out of the rock and had frozen in three streams. And he tells Hitchens, and Hitchens relays the story of how he dropped to his knees and accepted Jesus as his savior. Because he interpreted that as the Trinity.
Mm.
Boom. And it's like, okay. But it doesn't take away from the fact that he's still a brilliant scientist.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but again, like with this, with somebody writing in, you know, that Daniel's not just regular person. It's just like, and it's funny because I remember, one of the times when I was reading through Daniel, and it was this whole thing. It's like, and then I met Richard Carrier when he was up here doing a speaking tour, and he was talking about the book of Daniel, and mm-hmm. you know he said for the most, in his words during the talk, he said for the most part nobody really takes the book of Daniel seriously from a historical perspective.
Sure.
And I was like, whoa. And I asked him a question after. I'm like, what do you mean no one takes it? You know, he said, and they said, because it's pretty much accepted that it was not written at the time that it was supposed to have been written.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not written by the person that it's attributed to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we don't take it seriously. And so then when I read through it again, I'm like, wow, you know, it's almost like, people who will say, well, you know, you read the Old Testament, you read the New Testament, say, well, look, you know, there's a prophecy in the Old Testament and it's fulfilled in the New Testament. I'm just like, well, yeah, but you know, you have these people who control the text for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they read what was written in the Old Testament, and you know, it was like a choose your own adventure book. So they made sure that they wrote down, you know, what it needed to be to fulfill the prophecy. Doesn't speak anything to the truth of it.
Yeah. I think it's very difficult. Part of the thing that I deal with in my interactions, and you know, like on Skylar's channel, for example, is we have people that they're giving arguments that are very difficult to falsify, and not because it's not because they're difficult to falsify. It's not that they're falsifiable, but difficult to falsify.
Right.
It's that they're seemingly unfalsifiable. And to kind of move out of something that would be contentious to any Christian that's listening to me, when I was on the Non Sequitur show like a year and a half ago, and I'm going to try to remember the name. Oh, that's terrible. I have MS and... You've probably heard me mention that, but my memory just is terrible. But anyway, the cult basically follows Lord Ryle. I don't know if you've heard of that cult, but
not familiar. Okay.
Basically, he's reincarnated Jesus, sort of loosely, and I think they're still down in Baja, and you know he's gonna send the, it's like a weird cross between Christianity and Sitchin. You know, right. The Anunnaki. And anyway, they had their like public relations guy come on the show to debate me. And it was such an odd experience, because one of the things that they do is they use like a form of gematria. You know, they have the Hebrew of the Hebrew Bible laid out in rows without spaces in between it, and then they find, you know, words in the blocks of text, and it looks really convincing when you see it, right? Wow, look right here, it says Rael in Hebrew, and then crossing it is the word Messiah. Ooh, you know, wow, Rael is the Messiah, man, that's so, and look, this other one here goes diagonally across and it says end of the world. And this word in Hebrew says destruction. How is this possible? You know,
that's like Ken Hovind lines on paper.
It turns out that there's a computer program that you can buy, which I did. And when he presented that, I said, oh, And I, as Kyle or Steve screen shared or whatever, and or they put it up, and here's mine. And it says, Jay Bowen, you know, is the Messiah. And I mean, you can find really anything that you want.
It's like almost like numerology. It's like if you look long enough, you'll find the pattern, whether it's there or not.
Yeah, one of them said, I think McCray is Yahweh or something. I mean, like we played with it and had a lot of fun with it. But I guess what I'm saying is that when you come to particularly something like Daniel, a book that's written in apocalyptic genre, it's an apocalyptic text. You know, there's a great book out by Dr. Stephen Cook. He's up at Virginia Theological Seminary. And of course, John J. Collins has written extensively on apocalyptic genre. But Stephen Cook, apocalyptic genre is written, it's the end of the world is coming, right? Yeah. The world is terribly wicked right now. And all of the righteous people, all the good people, the ones that are following God, they're actually going to suffer because evil is in control right now and God is letting that happen. But don't you worry, hang on.
Right.
Because right around the corner, God's a-coming,
yeah.
Right? And he's going to come in on his white stallion and he's going to destroy all the wicked people and all the people that hold fast, right? All the people that stay strong through all this turmoil, they're going to be saved and, you know, they're going to have triumph and so on and so forth. Apocalyptic genre is written in such a way that it's specific enough and vague enough to be applied really broadly.
Right.
And so you can see Daniel being applied, and then you can see it being reapplied, and then you can see it being reapplied. And even down to today, people look at oh my goodness, here, look at this, the foe from the north, you know, the king that's coming from the south. This must be, you know, I don't know, Russia. This must be whatever. Right. And you can tell because you look at how the detail that it's giving, and it's like, well, okay, but what about the 45,000 other interpretations that have come before that, you know, and were wrong? Is it yours is somehow right? Because they all fit.
It's counting the hits and ignoring the misses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good way of saying it.
Yeah. So. Well, holy shit. We're an hour and 23 minutes already.
Oh, wow.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, this is really neat. I really appreciate you having me on.
This has been great. This has been absolutely great. Okay, so just quickly to recap, we're going to make sure we get links for Digital Hammurabi, the YouTube channel that you've got, plus Anna Mesopotamia. We got to get, and I'm almost just making a note for myself so we can connect via email later. A link for the.
If anybody, we have a website, just Digital Hammurabi, all one word. So Haurabi, because nobody knows how to spell Hammurabi. DigitalHammurabi.com. It's got links to all that stuff.
Oh, cool. All right. That means I can be way lazier.
If anybody wants to check out, you know, my credentials or whatever, my dissertation is up there free for download. I don't know that it'll be a page turner for most people that are listening, but you know, you can look and see if I have any idea what I'm talking about. But I really appreciate it.
Oh, this has been great. So, okay. I think that's enough trouble for us to get into for this week. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to come on. I look forward to hopefully the possibility that, and I think I mentioned this to you guys before, everybody listening, that Skylar is trying to work out something so that Ed, our former guest Ed, and I think he was on your channel as well, wasn't he?
He came on Skylar's channel a couple of times.
Trying to work on a talk, but just so you know, he wanted me to come on his podcast. But it's interesting because he was on here twice, and I got some negative feedback because of how he was, and so I told him, I said I'm not having you back on the podcast. And when he said, well, you should come on my podcast, and I told him flat out, I said, no, I don't trust you. I said I don't trust you to either not mute me or to edit what I've said to fit your narrative. And he got really butthurt over that. And then Skylar jumped in and offered up the possibility for a talk, and I guess Ed's mulling over that possibility, so that could be happening.
I know that just as a, you know, Ed, if you listen to this, or
Ed listens to every episode. He can't get it.
Oh,
does he?
I know that Skylar, and I'm sure Skylar's fine with me saying this, that Skylar can come across, you know, being a little over the top at times. But I actually do think that if you guys decide to do that, Skylar and I are actually, I think, really good at being fair moderators.
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
So I think it could be very productive if you guys are interested in doing that. So
yeah, I think that'd be totally cool. So, okay, that's closer to, yeah, so this is a typical episode for us, about an hour and a half long. So, and my voice is starting to fade.
Michael, thank you so much for having me on. This has been a lot of fun. It's a real pleasure.
This has been great. This will be up, probably tomorrow. So what the hell's tomorrow? Friday. Get it up there, tomorrow, and I'll make sure that I tag you in it. So, like we said before, we'll say our goodbyes here and then hang up, and or I'll stop the record button, and then we'll say a proper goodbye. So, all right. So that's it for this episode. I promise Dean will be back next week when his kids stop ruining his life, and and we'll be back at you with another episode. That'll be 102, climbing up there. Who knows? But, you know, it only took us 3 years to get to 100, so. Until next week, I have been Michael. This is where you say I've been Josh.
Oh, sorry. I've been Josh.
Yeah, like you knew, right? I just totally threw you under the bus. And we shall see you later.
This has been the CA. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please drop by the iTunes store and give us a review and subscribe to get the latest episodes as soon as they release. Just a reminder, the views expressed on this broadcast are solely those of the hosts and are for entertainment purposes only. Never take advice from two guys expressing an opinion on a podcast. That's just silly. See you back here soon.